From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As we reported earlier this past week, Russia's President Vladimir Putin made his annual report to Russia's parliament. To discuss some of the particulars of that address, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University, from Moscow via Skype this past Friday. Mark, welcome back.
Yeah, I don't want to interrupt the U.S. elections, Don. I know how important the next 2 years of primaries is until the next circus comes to town. The elections that never end but never seem to result in anything different somehow.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, isn't it?
But yeah, thanks for having me on, Don. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR with you.
It's our pleasure. So I guess we'll start with Russia's version of the State of the Union address, with we had listened to a good set of excerpts from President Putin's address to the Federated Assembly earlier this week, and maybe you could give us your take on that first.
Yeah, so, you know, this is the annual address. It's the president's address to the Federal Assembly, which is both houses of the Russian parliament, if you will, the Duma and the Federal Assembly, the Federation Council, as well as, you know, the High Court and other top government officials and celebrities. It's just like the State of the Union, basically. So this year's address to the Federal Assembly was an hour and a half. And out of that hour and a half, 1 hour and 15 minutes of it was devoted to domestic issues, which Putin made clear, you know, at the beginning of the address, are the priority for the country in the year and coming. And part of that is certainly, I you know, due to the drop in Putin's approval rating from perhaps the low 80s, high 70s, low 80s, to where it is today at about 67%, which is due almost exclusively to Putin signing off on the government's increasing of the Russian pension age to something close to what it is already in Western countries,
yeah.
Which has not been met well in Russia by, you know, really anyone. It's one of those things that if Russia didn't want to raise the pension age, that I would actually agree with that. But then you have to talk about where you make up the financial shortfall,
right,
as you have an aging population. These are the same discussions that have taken place at the in Western countries for decades now, as they rose up their pension ages. And if Russia didn't raise its pension age, then it would have to talk economically in entirely different terms, because that of course would mean that a large segment of their population, once they reach certain age, is no longer part of the economy as they are in all Western countries. So
right,
that would, you know, put Russia at a comparative disadvantage. Not that that should be the only concern, of course, you know, you need to raise tax revenue to support the rising pension demographic, the same graying population phenomenon that all industrialized countries are having as they have fewer children and the populations get older. And that's something that all governments across the world are struggling to do in a world create, you know, with a free flow of capital and tax havens, right? How do you tax your wealthiest more when they just, you know, to make up for shortfalls in other areas when they simply move their wealth offshore to these tax havens?
And that's right,
this isn't a problem that exclusively Russia is facing. You know, it's a problem that every country in the world, other than those few tax havens, are facing. So, a good portion of it was of this domestic portion was talking about a number of specific measures that are being implemented to encourage families to have more children. Decreased mortgage rates for families with two or more children. More government, you want to call it welfare, it's payments that are made to families that have more two or more children. And a number of other measures that are specifically designed to help families with two or more children and enjoy a higher standard of living. Another portion was talking about a number of specific measures that are being focused on healthcare. Russia still has free universal healthcare. It's not quite what it was in the Soviet Union. At least it dropped down in the 90s. Everything that I've heard from people who have been using it recently are talking about actually how surprised and how good it is, preventative care and other things. But certainly it does need an increase in money, if nothing else, for the salaries of the doctors and nurses and for, you know, newer a continual supply of newer equipment and facilities and so on. So he highlighted a number of there. He did briefly address the pension system. Mm. He addressed the issue of which he was extremely critical, and you could say even a little cynical, of the environment, specifically on the environment. He was talking about the problem it has been a problem in the Moscow regions that have generated small protests, but of which, of course, the pro-Western liberal opposition tried to latch themselves onto and make into a bigger deal. But, you know, it does have a serious concern. It's about landfills that are you know, increasingly filled up with trash, right, that are located close to residential buildings. And this is kind of in the suburban belt, if you want to call it that, outside of Moscow, where this has been a problem. It's something that has certainly, reached, the national ears, even if it is a local problem, because it is the Moscow region. And he was very critical of the government bureaucracy that has allowed residential buildings to be built near landfills as they, started to get bigger, and vice versa.
Right.
He's basically promised executive action on this. But of course, it's not a problem that can be immediately solved overnight. But he certainly there has been some noise, again, mostly in the Moscow region about this. But he certainly moved to draw it to national attention, and you could say playing the good czar. He's putting the focus on the local officials, who are responsible for creating the situation and should be responsible for alleviating it.
Right.
So he also talked about increased money for particularly school education, particularly kindergartens and primary schools, some more science and research and development funding. A big contrast, as you pointed out to me before, between the tone of the American State of the Union address, in that it's less on the America, fist pumping in the air, clapping rhetoric, right, and a little bit more on specific details. You've raised these issues. We've noticed that you're unhappy with these things. These are the things that we're going to try to improve the situation, and down to if not minutia, then at least indicating, specific policies and direction moving forward in an attempt to create these problems. But this whole first hour and 15 minutes is pretty much devoted to increasing the living standard for Russians, particularly Russians outside of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and the other first-tier cities, which Russians, in general, one of the reasons they support the Putin and his governments so much is that compared to the 1990s, the GDP per capita in the country has increased four times.
That's pretty good.
I mean, it started from a very low rate because you have to understand, of course, how far the economy fell under the U.S.-backed liberal Yeltsin kleptocracy, how far things fell from what they had been before, dropped down, and then were picked back up again by Putin. So this is all, you know, considering that, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years, Russia has been under very increasingly tight layer of U.S. and other European client state sanctions on Russia, and which caused a slight recession for a couple of years, you know, -1% or something. It was coupled with the oil price war with Saudi Arabia, which eventually Saudi Arabia blinked on, and they've cooperated in the last 2 years to raise oil prices back up to a level that can support both of their countries' economies. Russia's growth in 2018 was 2.3%, which is above the average for the European Union states. This is despite the effects of U.S. and European sanctions and other economic warfare on the country. So I think it goes a good way to showing that the independence that the Russia government has brought to the finance and the economy, the finance sector and the economy in general. The agricultural sector is still booming as a result, actually, of the sanctions. You know, the attempt to isolate Russia, you know, that this is what they called it, has only proven that the West is not the world, and Russia has simply increased trade even more with China and India and the Middle East and Southeast Asia and so on to compensate for that. And another milestone was reached just in the last week, that Russia's currency reserves now, Russia runs a budget surplus, not a deficit, because they have a very tight fiscal control. They don't want to expose the country to the control, the U.S. control from the heights of global finance. So they run a very tight economy. Russia doesn't spend more money than it has. It runs a budget surplus and actually still has substantial currency reserves, both in currency, gold, and other things, although it's moving away from the U.S. dollar. And Russia's debt, not just the government debt, not just the region and local debt, but including all corporate and consumer debt in Russia, total Russian debt, everything, is now lower than Russia's currency reserves.
Wow.
Yeah, that, I mean, wow. That compare that to the U.S., where we're now looking at $22 trillion of just federal debt. And if you include in state, city, local debt, you're already there talking $60 trillion. And then you could talk about, of course, the U.S. Debt society, the consumer society with credit cards and mortgages and car loans and education payments and medical payments and so on. It draws a stark contrast. Of course, the U.S. Wow. has the advantage there as long as they can continue the process of quantitative easing, as they call it, printing money. To meet their, you know, their interest payments, their debt, because the U.S. is the global currency. But all of these sanctions and tariffs and everything they're doing against countries from you know, not only Russia but China and Venezuela and North Korea and Syria and Iran, and threatening sanctions against even their allies, European companies that do business in these countries, these new secondary sanctions and so on, and the war of tariffs around the war being waged not only against China and others, but against U.S. allies, Canada and South Korea. It's all making this ability of the U.S. to continue this process of financial impunity and basically not even believing that its national debt exists, because the world, the dollar is the world's reserve currency. It's weakening. It's eroding that position. And eventually, it maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, but the process has already begun, where countries are seriously now looking at ways of conducting exchange in each other's currencies, barter systems, and finding payment systems that go around SWIFT and other measures of a U.S. controlling global finance. So I think the Russian economy is actually kind of an example in that way. It's a tight ship, and there, some things are not splurged on. But when you take a look at the debt levels in Russia, and you talk about it compared to the U.S. or even to other European countries, you know, China or Japan with near 200%. Debt to GDP ratio, and Germany and the United Kingdom also having, you know, extremely high and I would consider unhealthy debt levels. Russia has no debt. So, I mean, this is all what the first part of Russia's State of the Union was, and the majority part.
In the last 15 minutes. You know, it did not sound like an austerity speech at all. In other words, you know, if you were looking at somebody that tightening their belt, saying we got to get a handle on, our debt load, we got to get a handle on our balance of payments, we got to get a handle on, you know, all these different things, and so consequently, we're going to have to go without this, that, or the other thing. It was not that at all.
No, because that's not the situation at all. Russia has finished the belt tightening. They are in growth, right? The economy is growing. They've reduced military spending in the last year by 20% because they have met the country's military modernization goals. Right, Russia fell far behind in the 90s. They know they're never going to be a global superpower. Right, they don't need aircraft carriers, you know, flying off to nations on the other side of the world, you know, to rain hell and fury and regime change down in other countries. But they built a very capable, localized military with limited power projection capability and a high degree of technological advancement on certain specific areas like electronic warfare, air defense, and hypersonic weapons, strategic deterrent, and so on, that it feels it needs for its security and regional security in its own neck of the woods as a great power, but not a superpower. And they built that, so they reduced military spending. That we're saying we're back in growth. We've reduced military spending. National prestige projects of the last few years, the Olympics, the World Cup, they're over. Now we're going to focus more money on living standards. And this is where we're going to direct that money. And this is where you should look that we hope to see results. It's that laid out.
Okay, so then you have the last 15 minutes, which deals with something else.
Yeah, the last 15 minutes. Like, there's a section of the State of the Union address that it deals with foreign policy. And specifically on this, I would have to say what I looked for, there wasn't a lot on the two conflicts that Russia is involved in varying degrees in Syria and Ukraine, right? There wasn't a lot in there on that, probably because in the last year, the situation hasn't changed dramatically on either of those two situations. But the first thing that talked about that Putin talked about was not the West. It was about Asia. It was about the growing, ever-growing trade and cooperation with China, the growing connections with Southeast Asia, opening relations further with Japan and South Korea, showing where Russia's economic and foreign policy priority are right now. It's with Asia. It's not with the West anymore. And then specifically to highlight that, he turned then back to the West and talked about the situation there. And basically he said, you know, we're not going to keep knocking on a door that has been locked, right? Saying that the impetus for deteriorating relations, Russia feels was due to the U.S. And the rest of the West. And that at this point, if Russia is done knocking on that locked door, and if the U.S. and the West want to improve relations, good. That's what we would prefer. But the initiative is now your responsibility. Right. We're not going to keep knocking anymore. And if you don't want to improve relations, that's not our preference, but we can do that too. Right. And, you know, and even after the State of the Union address, you went a little further. Do you want another Cuban Missile Crisis? We don't want one, but right. we can go down that road if you want. And he spent a lot of time then talking specifically about the U.S. withdrawing from the unilaterally withdrawing from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and Russia then reciprocating, and that treaty with both having withdrawn. There's a six-month period, and in just under 6 months now, the treaty will be completely dead. And he highlighted, he saw that, he says that is a potential threat to our national security, to our strategic deterrent, and we will take specifically reciprocal steps. Specifically, the Pentagon last year, before the U.S. pulled out of the treaty, already allocated $58 million in the defense budget to research the building of new land-based intermediate, short and intermediate range missiles, right? What was banned by the treaty. Not the research and development wasn't banned, but the production and deployment was banned.
Right.
But this is already getting a step up on that. Russia said, fine, we're going to allocate that money. If the U.S. moves to production, we will move to production. If the U.S. deploys, if it somehow convinces European states to once again make the European continent a target between the U.S. and Russia, then if the U.S. deploys missiles, be they conventional or nuclear land-based intermediate-range missiles in Europe, then we will target those missiles and we will target the command and control centers.
Right.
It didn't specify where that would be, whether it's in Europe or the United States, that are responsible for making those decisions. And with the new hypersonic weapons, and he talked about several of them in particular and some other weapons that Russia is developing and seems to have at least a 10-year leg up in the United States on, that the response time of these weapons will be symmetrical. They will be equivalent to anything the U.S. puts there. And this is the thing. The U.S. pulling out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, everyone I think who's serious about this knows that it's not actually about Russia. I think I've said before on other formats that it seems likely Russia and the U.S. have both made complaints about each other violating it. It seems that both countries probably have violated it in small ways that are not an existential threat or, you know, a big strategic threat to each other or to Europe. If you notice, it's not the Europeans that are making the initiative out of this.
Yeah.
And Russia and the U.S. aren't particularly threatened by each other's intermediate range weapons, right? Because that would mean Alaska and Vladivostok. That's
right.
The range,
right.
You know, up to 5,500 kilometers. That's
right.
That's the range of these weapons. It's ICBMs, right? That threaten each other's, and those were never, you know, banned by this,
right.
You know, long range missiles, or sea and air wasn't banned by the treaty. So. Both countries are actually probably more concerned with building conventional land-based missiles. We're talking about land-based Tomahawks, basically, because while sea and air wasn't banned by the treaty, both countries would like to have some more land-based conventional intermediate-range missiles. Why? Because they're the only two countries bound by this treaty. China.
Right.
Israel, Iran, France, the UK, India, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, all of these countries are not bound by this treaty and did. And what the U.S. is really concerned about, it's not this excuse that Russia violated it, so we're pulling out. It's China. And that was made clear by statements in both Trump and Bolton when they announced that the U.S. was pulling out of it. They mentioned China again and again. Why? Because their real concern is that the U.S. geopolitical thinkers, the top brass, the strategists, they all believe that a U.S.-China showdown on the other side of the Pacific, in the South China Sea, to contain China navally, right, militarily, is inevitable. They believe they will have to fight that in the short to medium term within the next 20 years. And China is now gaining the advantage not only with the size and quality of their navy, but with 95% of some of China's missiles being short and intermediate range, fired from land. And many of these missiles are now carrier killers, right? They can take out U.S. surface right. ships, and they're gaining an advantage there. And the U.S., while it has sea and air-launched intermediate, short intermediate-range conventional missiles, it would like to have them land-based as well. Basically, the U.S., particularly the U.S. Army, which wants a piece of this military pie as the U.S. moves to confrontation with China in the Pacific, it wants to put land-based missiles in Guam, in Japan, and probably in South Korea as well. That might actually be a little bit more of a threat to Russia. Right. But, you know, the concern there primarily is would be North Korea, I think. And that's what they're looking at. Russia, you know, they Putin made this clear as far back as 2007. Once the U.S. pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty unilaterally, the INF treaty wasn't in Russia's best interest. It probably never was. Soviet generals made that clear, that it was basically a gift to the United States. It was right. far more advantageous to them as a maritime power and far more restrictive to the Soviet Union, which is a land-based continental power.
But
Russia wasn't going to pull out because it didn't want the rest of the Cold War strategic a treaty architecture to collapse, and that's why it kept as part of the treaty, and it made efforts to address the U.S. concerns. Let's have mutual inspections. You can inspect our missiles that you say are over the range, the allowed range, and we can inspect your anti-ballistic missile MK-41 Aegis Ashore launchers that you've put in Romania and are putting in Poland, because they are also a violation of the treaty. And we want to inspect those to make sure that they can't fire, you know, the missiles prescribed by this treaty, because the launchers were also banned. And the U.S. said, no, we're not interested. That we're not interested in solving it. It's the responsibility is all yours. We're not even going to talk, address the idea that we have violated it as well. Or, you know, if at all, and we're not interested in this treaty. And the U.S. has already gave far more seriously indication that it will, that in 2 years, the New START treaty, which limits, is a far more important treaty even than the INF, it limits the amount of missiles and warheads that each side has actively deployed. The U.S. has already indicated, given signals, that it is not interested in renewing that treaty. And that would see the last bit of the old Cold War nuclear treaty architecture.
Yeah, the whole
collapse.
Architecture is kind of doing that. Well, you know, to be mindful of it, of course, the context has changed dramatically from 30 years ago. So we're going to have to stop here because we're out of time, but... this might be a good place to pick up next week, taking a look at what has changed and perhaps what people might be looking for going forward. So, Mark, thanks a lot for your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
We'll speak with you next week. And that was Mark Sloboda, Senior Lecturer in International Affairs at Moscow State University, speaking to us via Skype from Moscow Friday. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.